Hello, this is Randy Thompson from the North Carolina Reading Service. Welcome to Music Review. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. For the next half hour, I shall be reading articles about music from such sources as the New York Times, the News and Observer, the Week Magazine, Rolling Stone, and Classic FM. Music Review is underwritten by Bill McClure, tuning pianos in the Raleigh area since 1968. For more information or to schedule a piano tuning appointment, please call 919-779-1755. This program is designed to provide the latest coverage of classical, folk, jazz, country, rock, and pop music news. But first, these musical trivia questions. Today's trivia questions come to us from Fox News, that's VOX News, and Britannica.com. Question number one. The term falsetto is based on the Italian for what? Is it A, chest voice? Is it B, tongue twist? Is it C, false soprano? Or is it D, throat clear? So what is the Italian basis for that term anyway? And question number two, why don't women sing falsetto? Is it A, it's simply based on tradition? Is it B, it's unnecessary? Is it C, it's biologically difficult? Or is it D, it's restricted to boy choirs? Falsetto. Why not women, too? The answers to these two important trivia questions will be given, as usual, at the end of today's program. Our transitions come to us from the website onthisday.com, and today, quote-unquote, is the weekend of April the 7th. Well, it was on this very day back in 1949 that the musical South Pacific by Rodgers and Hammerstein debuted on Broadway. 1949 today. And it was 59 years ago today, 1964, that the Supremes recorded Where Did Our Love Go? The song was their first number one single today in 1964. Mozart's Piano Concerto No. 18 in B-flat major, K-456, introduces our classical music news. It's titled, Apple Wants to Solve One of Music's Biggest Problems. This is written by Ben Cohen, published in the Wall Street Journal on the 1st of April, 2023. Everyone who listens to Beethoven as much as they jam to Beyoncé knows it is basically impossible to find the perfect recording of your favorite violinist playing in the best concert hall with the ideal conductor. The world's richest company releases a sleek new product this week that was years in the making and had to meet its exacting standards before it was ready to be used by millions of people. But it wasn't a phone, a gadget, or an AI chatbot. The latest innovation from Apple was a better way of listening to classical music. The mere announcement of a standalone app for the genre was music to the ears of flummoxed artists and frustrated aficionados who were desperate for a major classical music streaming platform that actually worked. That is the point of Apple Music Classical. It is a bespoke product for the Baroque period and beyond. It was designed to bring order to the chaos of information, the holy grail of many tech ventures, and simplify the unnecessarily complex. and it only exists because of a curious failure by the most successful music streaming services. "We always had a problem," said Jonathan Gruber, the head of Apple Music's classical. "A big, big problem. The problem was the way that classical music is categorized. The structure of classical music is completely different from pop music's, which makes it extremely difficult for it to function in the streaming era. Even the most sophisticated algorithms from the most technologically advanced companies are too clumsy to handle composers like Mozart and Brahms. That's because they were made for individual artists like Bad Bunny and Madonna. If you want to hear a Bad Bunny song, it will be in your ears within seconds. If you want to hear a Brahms piano concerto, good luck. Try sifting through hundreds of recordings without a standardized format to track down one movement from a particular soloist who has performed it several times. You could listen to an entire Madonna album in the time it takes to find the right Mozart. It is a big, big problem, and it drives Bruce Kovner bananas." "I've been working on solving this kind of problem for my own personal consumption for 20 years, said Mr. Kovner, a retired hedge fund manager and the chairman emeritus of the Juilliard School's board. In fact, it has vexed classical music for longer than two decades, as the problem goes back to the establishment of recordings over a century ago, said Jane Gottlieb, Juilliard's vice president for library and information resources. But it's especially annoying that Apple Music and Spotify have turned out phones into jukeboxes and still can't figure out box suites. The experience of classical music on major streaming platforms would make Yo-Yo Ma want to smash his cello. Mr. Kovner hacked together his own system, ripping thousands of albums, tagging the recordings to make them searchable, and subscribing to Spotify and niche services like Adagio to fill the holes in his collection, because he was so exasperated by the streaming options. They treat every piece as if it were the same, said Mr. Kovner. For classical music nuts like me, that's not the case. Every performance is interesting when it is unique. But you don't have to be a nut to understand why classical music breaks the algorithms. You could just compare Taylor Swift and Tchaikovsky. For a Taylor Swift pop song, the essential pieces of metadata, or the taxonomic labels that categorize information, are the album and artist. The metadata for a Tchaikovsky track can include not just the name of the work, composer, and artist, but also the nickname, movement, key, opus, number, orchestra, soloist, and conductor. It gets really nerdy and very specific and very complicated, said Ms. Gottlieb. Another way of thinking about classical music's biggest problem is distinguishing repertoire from recordings. A pop star like Taylor Swift is the recording artist for her repertoire. But one piece of Tchaikovsky's repertoire has many recordings, as if every Taylor Swift single had thousands of covers. The streaming platforms are optimized for Taylor Swift and not Tchaikovsky. We knew we needed to fix the product in terms of search and discovery, said Mr. Gruber. That required taking vast quantities of information and turning them into something digestible, then accessible, then consumable. This is one of the fundamental challenges in almost every industry today. There has never been so much available data, but it can become too much data without the proper metadata. For any business that depends on search, Netflix, Google, and even this very newspaper. Metadata is one of the secrets to organizing the universe. It is why this app that brings the past into the present also happens to be a peek at the future. But the problem of classical music turned out to be so big that not even a company worth $2.5 trillion could solve it alone. Instead, Apple studied the market for classical-only products and orchestrated a takeover of PrimePhonic, a startup based in Amsterdam with a few dozen employees. As conservatory-trained musicians fluent in code, they were uniquely qualified for this line of infrastructural work, having designed and built a classical music database that consists of every data attribute of all composed and recorded work. Apple acquired PrimePhonic for an undisclosed price in 2021 and inherited that precious metadata. Now it is the engine behind Apple Music Classical, which comes included with an Apple Music subscription. A flaw of one product became the defining feature of another. And in music research and technology, we have this article titled, The Wild World of Music. What can elephants, birds, and flamenco players teach a neuroscientist composer about music? This is published in The New Yorker on the 27th of March, 2023, by Burkhard Bilger. Luke Kopp didn't seem to have the makings of a musical prodigy. He didn't hum made-up tunes to himself as a youngster or shake his head when someone sang flat. He didn't build instruments out of sticks and gourds or blow trumpet solos as a five-year-old. He had a brief moment of fame as a child actor in the Disney film Operation Dumbo Drop, but grew into a sullen and ungainly teen. When the composer and instrumentalist Dave Soldier first met him in Thailand in 2000, Luke Kopp spent most of his time eating grass and hanging around with the other elephants. He'd been deemed too truculent to mix with tourists. Soldier was in Thailand to recruit musicians for an elephant orchestra. He had hit upon the idea with a conservationist and advisor at the Thai Elephant Conservation Center, where Luke Kopp lived. In the spring of 1999, when Lair was on a research trip in New York, he and Soldier stayed up late one night at Soldier's place in Chinatown, talking about elephant art. Russian artists had recently taught some of the sanctuary's animals to paint with oils by holding brushes in their trunks. The results were exhibited at the Museum of Contemporary Art, Australia, and auctioned off at Christie's for more than $30,000. One critic compared them to abstract expressionism, but bright colors on a canvas are easy to like. Music is a harder sell. To anyone other than a parent, a grade school orchestra sounds like a crate of instruments falling down a staircase. Why would elephants be any better? Asian elephants have been trained by humans for more than 4,000 years. They've learned to pull plows, carry tree trunks, clear paths, and trample armies. Some female elephants are both so intelligent and so even-tempered that villagers in Thailand have used them as babysitters. Still, the orchestra was a stretch. Studies had found that elephants could identify simple melodies and distinguish pitches as little as a half step apart. But that didn't mean that they would make good musicians, at least of the sort that play in an orchestra. When Soldier explained his plan to the elephant trainers at the sanctuary, they reacted with slightly irritated bemusement, he later recalled. The first challenge was making instruments. Anything an elephant played had to be weatherproof and extremely durable. It had to be operable without hands or fingers, and it had to be very large. Working with the carpenters at the sanctuary, Soldier built an elephant-sized xylophone, a drum, and a single-stringed instrument that looked like a washtub bass. The blade of a huge circular saw that was abandoned by a tree poacher was turned into a gong. Initially, Soldier had all the instruments tuned to C-sharp pentatonic scale so they would sound good together. Then he mixed in more instruments and tunings. A metal worker in a nearby town built some marimbas and thunder sheets. A Canadian artist designed a synthesizer that the elephants could play with their trunks. And Soldier brought in bells, harmonicas, and mouth organs from northeastern Thailand. Within 4 years, 16 elephants were playing a full orchestra's worth of instruments. After that first trip to Thailand, Soldier played some recordings of the elephants for a music critic at the Times. He didn't mention who the musicians were. The critic listened intensely for a while, then ventured that the group must be Asian. He could tell from the repertoire, he said, though he couldn't identify the players. Soldier must have been delighted by that, but he insists that he wasn't trying to catch the man out. He was just posing a question in the most direct way possible that had preoccupied him most of his life. What makes music music? Soldier is of two minds. As a composer and violinist, he doesn't like to define music too strictly. He prefers to mix genres, blur categories, erase the boundaries between rock and classical, melody and noise, animal and human. But music is just Soldier's night job, the thing he does when he's not at the office. By day, he has another name and identity, David Sulzer, professor of psychiatry, neurology, and pharmacology at Columbia University. His music was rarely about science, and his science touched only glancingly on music, and they came to draw on opposite sides of his personality. The language of neuroscience itself is rooted in music. The word synapse comes from the Greek synaph, the note that connects one octave to the next as you go up a scale, the note that, quote-unquote, brings us back to do, as Julie Andrews sang. Music is so ingrained in us, it's almost like primitive than language, Sulzer told me. An old man with Alzheimer's might hear a Tin Pan Alley tune and suddenly recall his daughter's name. A young woman with Parkinson's will stand frozen on a stair, unable to move her legs, but if she hums a rhythm to herself, her foot will take a step. I know of one man who had a stroke so severe that he could barely talk, Sulzer said, but he could still sing. Music is a kind of skeleton key, opening countless doorways in the mind. Of all the world's humming, squawking, buzzing, and growling creatures, birds may be the most single-mindedly musical. They sing when the sun rises and again when it sets. They sing to find mates and to claim territory. They sing to soothe their chicks and to sound alarms. Still, it's not clear how much we can generalize. Do birds take pleasure in singing, or is it just utilitarian? Do they share our sense of beauty in music? When Sulzer was working with the Elephant Orchestra, he knew that the music they played wasn't really their own. It was just an approximation, as foreign to them as fiddling on a cricket's wings would be to us. The orchestra went on to record 3 CDs, but no one could hear what the elephants were humming to themselves in the deep subsonic of their own frequency as the drums clattered and gongs crashed. We are just at the beginning, Sulzer told me. There is a whole auditory world around us that we've ignored. So, how'd you do on today's trivia questions? Well, the answer to our first question, the term falsetto is based on the Italian for what? Is it A, chest voice, B, tongue twist, C, false soprano, or D, throat clear? Correct answer? Answer C, false soprano. As noted in Britannica.com, falsetto is the upper register of the human voice, the opposite of chest voice. Though sometimes considered synonymous with head voice, the Italian term falsetto means false soprano. The key difference between the terms treble and soprano is that treble refers to a high-frequency tone, especially of a boy, while soprano refers to a high voice or higher pitch of a female. And the answer to our second question, why don't women sing falsetto? Is it A, it's simply based on tradition? Is it B, it's unnecessary? Is it C, it's biologically difficult? Or is it D, it's restricted to boy choirs? Correct answer, answer B. It's essentially unnecessary. As noted in the Britannica.com article, since soprano is the highest female voice type, the term falsetto or false soprano has therefore been used to describe only the adult male's head voice, in which the vocal cords vibrate in a length shorter than usual and somewhat apart with a permanent oval orifice between the edges. In choirs of men and boys, especially in England, there is a long, uninterrupted tradition of adult male altos singing falsetto. Clemency Burton Hill, in a BBC.com article published on 4/4/2016, titled The Grisly History of the Men Who Sing Like Women, at first, you can scarcely believe your ears, so arresting is the sound of a countertenor makes. Chances are you've already often heard men scaling the sorts of vocal heights normally reserved for female sopranos. If you've ever heard a Bee Gees record, for example, you'd be familiar with a male falsetto. But a classical countertenor, this powerful yet ethereally pure noise emanating from a grown man transports you somewhere else altogether. It is unique, startling, and once heard can never be forgotten. The countertenor is a 20th century vocal phenomenon, the fascinating and occasionally disturbing history of which stretches back generations and now occupies an exciting and distinctive place in the 21st century musical landscape. Although pioneering countertenors are widely celebrated in the classical world, men singing professionally in a women's vocal register used to be rare. But in recent years, the emergence of some new major artists has coincided with the resurgence of Baroque repertoire, calling for a voice part that would originally have been sung by a male castrato, and then, in more humane times, by a female mezzo-soprano. But what on earth is a countertenor, and how on earth did it get to be so glamorous? It's often mistakenly thought of as a female-sounding voice, but actually, all men have the ability to produce falsetto. Some just choose to do it all the time. In pop, a la Barry Gibb, it's more about an extension of the singer's tenor or baritone singing voice. Since when the melody gets too high or there's a desire for that quality of tone, they might break into their falsetto. Much of the countertenor repertoire comes through the sacred church music tradition and the world of 17th and 18th century opera. The fact contemporary composers are writing new works with countertenors involved is a boon. We often forget how important it is to keep music alive, not just by performing the famous scores, but also creating new ones for us to enjoy now and for future generations to do so too. But pop music also has its falsettos. Here we have, for example, an example. From 1965.
Every boy wants a girl he can trust to the very end. Baby, that's you. Walk your way.
singer Lou Christie's falsetto 1965 hit, Lightning Strikes, introduces this 8-13, 2019 related piece from Estelle Caswell in Vox News titled, We Measured Pop Music's Falsetto Obsession. It's nearly impossible to turn on the radio and not hear a male artist singing really high. Likely he's a tenor, and more often than not, he'll sing in falsetto. Think Justin Bieber, Bruno Mars, Drake, Adam Levine. The list goes on and on and on. This isn't a trend. It's been the status quo for decades. The authors analyzed 20,000 songs that charted on the Billboard Hot 100 using vocal data sourced from Pandora's Music Genome Project to figure out just how popular falsetto singing actually is. Turns out, falsetto was quite popular in 70s disco and even 80s hard rock. A SmoothRadio.com article from 2022 adds, Frankie Valli is one of the most successful singers and performers of all time. Best known as the frontman of the Four Seasons from the 60s, he's also known for his powerful falsetto singing voice. Nearly 20 years before Barry Gibb of the Bee Gees conquered the charts. Frankie Valli scored 38 top 40 hits either as a solo artist or with the Four Seasons, a group inducted into the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame in 1990. So let's close today's program with 1964 falsetto hit of Frankie Valli, Sherry. Well, we've run out of time for today's episode of Music Review. Be sure to tune in at the same time next week. This program is also available as a podcast after the broadcast in our website, ncreadingservice.org. As we leave you now, remember these words, kindness is a language which blind people see and deaf people hear. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. If you have a suggestion for music to feature on this program, please leave a message for me at 919-832-5138. I'm Randy Thompson, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. Music Review underwritten by Bill McClure, tuning pianos in the Raleigh area since 1968. For more information, call 919-779-1755. So long, until next time. Sherry May.